You're listening to WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, supporting the knowledge that freedom of expression is essential to a free society. And good morning. Welcome to Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater, bringing Claudio coast to coast and the speakeasy to your doorstep. Your host, Claudio, Renaissance man and bard of WCOM, has opened the doors once again of the speakeasy to invite you all to come in. Come as you are, find a seat, get comfortable in the place where you're always welcome and can always expect the very best. And good morning, Claudio.
Good morning. Come naked, bring the popcorn, however you want to do it.
Yes, but if you come naked, you have to bring the popcorn.
Okay, that's the deal. She just wrote the law.
Yes.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for tuning us in. This is Claudio. The fellow we're going to have on in a few short minutes is Jimmy Bird, who's a mechanic for NASCAR and also had some victories dirt track racing back in his day. And he's going to cue us in on the sport of racing on really all sides of it. I think it's going to be a wonderful education. I mean, I've heard these stories driving over here. I let him drive today, so I drove
and
with
it. And you got here all right?
Yeah. I'm still shaking, but yes. I'm okay.
Well, he's promised to get you on the way back.
So good morning, Jimmy, and welcome.
Good morning, Claudio.
Welcome to the speakeasy. I just want to read something here that's very close to my heart, something Audrey actually made me aware of, and that is, everything the media told you about Occupy Wall Street is wrong. This is actually a statement from CNBC contributor, also to MSNBC commentator, and former White House aide, right?
Yep, and he's from, this is on Huffington Post.
And the fellow's name is Keith Boykin, and he went and explored the situation just to see if what the media was telling us was true and discovered that our media is not giving us the real scoop on what's happening with these people occupying Wall Street. They're trying to make them sound like rebels without a cause, and I think this will put a different spin on it. This was posted on 10/19/11. After 10 days out of town, I finally made it to Occupy Wall Street on Tuesday and had a chance to see for myself what's going on. My conclusion, almost everything the media told me about the protest is wrong. Based on my observations, here's what I consider the top 10 myths about Occupy Wall Street. Myth number one, the movement is violent. One of the most striking images I witnessed at the demonstration was a young black man holding a sign that read, End NYPD Violence, in front of a group of police officers. The officers quickly challenged his accusation, but the young man didn't leave. Next, the police turned away and ignored him, but he still didn't leave. Then the officers chuckled and let out an unexpected laugh when they realized the man wasn't going away. The scene was confrontational, but definitely not violent. In fact, one of the first things I noticed was a sign posted on a wall that embraced Kingian nonviolence, the peaceful principles that guided Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Myth number two, and if anybody wants to come in and say anything to this, please feel free to add on. Otherwise, I'm just going to read straight through. Myth number two, it's just a bunch of pampered kids. Although I supported the concept of the Occupy Wall Street movement when I first heard of it, I admit I didn't think the group had much to offer me. Actually, I personally have been of the same opinion. From what I could see in the media, they were well-educated, well-intentioned, young white people, but they didn't really represent me. I was wrong. What I found was a wide-ranging group of people from various backgrounds, young and old, male and female, black, white, Latin, Asian, and mixed. It was the essence of New York, the reason why I moved to this city 10 years ago. Myth number three, there are no black people involved. I was taken aback by how many black and Latino participants I noticed at the demonstration. I hadn't seen them on the television coverage of the movement, but they were clearly there. Myth number four, they're anti-American. In my experience, I saw a lot of American flags being waved proudly at the demonstration. The protesters may not all think the same things, but many of them were clearly hoping America would live up to its promise as a land of opportunity where the rules are fair and all are welcome. Excuse me. Myth number five. They're just modern-day hippies. To watch some of the media coverage of the movement, you would think the protest was filled with long-haired hippies left over from the 1960s. In fact, from my experience, I saw a few people who might fit this description, but I also saw just about every type of person you could imagine at the demonstration. There were high school-aged kids with their parents, college students in their school sweatshirts, men in business suits, mothers with baby carriages, people with jobs, people who were unemployed, white-haired retirees, African drummers, rhythmic dancers, and one person who appeared to be wearing pajamas. He was taking it rather easy.
He was getting ready to come to the speakeasy.
Yes, indeed. He was. He must have been on his way. He still hasn't arrived, but we're expecting him. Myth number six. They don't know what they want. Now, this, I have to say, has been a bit of a concern of mine, that they hadn't made a clear statement. So, myth number six, they don't know what they want. I found many different people gathered in Zuccotti Park with many different interests and agendas, but they seem to be unified by one common purpose. They're tired of a system that seems only to cater to the rich and powerful while ignoring the concerns of the vast majority of Americans. That actually has a lot to say for our political system overall. You're a bit involved in psychology, Audrey. Isn't it a declared statement that if the true measure of insanity is to do the same thing over and over and over again and expect a different result?
That's what Einstein said.
Yeah, well, yes. Aren't we doing that with our political system? Mm-hmm. The whole country's gone nuts. So consider that. Myth number seven. The labor unions are behind this. I saw only one labor union table at the demonstration, but most of the people seem to have no connection to organized labor. Even if they had, there's nothing wrong with that. Labor unions are an important part of our country, and while not perfect, they've helped throughout history to improve working conditions for millions of Americans. Myth number eight. They're pro-Obama, they're anti-Obama. I don't have the facts to back this up. Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain said in an interview recently, but I happen to believe that these demonstrations are planned and orchestrated to distract from the failed policies of the Obama administration. That seems unlikely. Long after I arrived, I found a Hispanic man in a camouflage jacket complaining about Obama to a small crowd of onlookers. "Obama is not the savior," he cried out, moments after he finished, a young black man in a sweat jacket stood up to defend Obama to the crowd, acknowledging that the president wasn't perfect, but he was doing the best job he could to clean up the mess, the George Bush mess he had inherited. Both sides had their points to make, and both were respectfully acknowledged. Myth number nine, they're in the wrong place. I love to hear conservatives complaining that the protesters should be in Washington instead of Wall Street, as if the conservatives were really concerned about the most effective way for the demonstrators to make their case. This location-based argument suggests a limiting either-or mentality, mm-hmm. that you can't be in both places, and it also assumes that there's no reason to be on Wall Street at all. As Herman Cain said recently, "Don't blame Wall Street. Don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself." Well, there's an arrogance. But there's a good reason why Wall Street... I've always said I should have taken down Wall Street with a Berlin Wall. That's the American Berlin Wall. But there's a good reason why Wall Street serves as an ideal venue for the demonstration. Unlike politicians in Washington who have to answer to voters every few years, corporate executives on Wall Street don't have to answer to the public, even though their actions have a huge impact on all of us. It seems to me the protesters picked a reasonable venue to launch their movement. In fact, judging by the row of satellite trucks parked outside the protest, I'd say Wall Street was exactly the right place to draw attention to their cause.
Hit 'em where the money is.
That's right. That's right. Myth number 10. Pardon me if I'm rushing through this. I'm trying to get it all said as quickly as possible. They're taking over Wall Street, myth number 10. I have lived in New York City for 10 years, but I'd never been to Zuccotti Park until the Occupy Wall Street protests took place. I assumed the protesters were cramped out at a park somewhere at the end of Wall Street, throwing around garbage and creating a mess. Once again, I was wrong. First, the group was clean, neat, and orderly when I saw them. The park was actually cleaner than any park I've ever seen in New York City. Some demonstrators were even walked around with brooms to clean up any mess that might have been left, and signs were posted advising the occupiers to observe a good neighbor policy. That's a pretty classy thing to attach to a movement. Finally, as it turns out, Zuccotti Park isn't even on Wall Street. It's a couple of blocks away. As you can see from the image below, the only, and this is referring to a computer image, the only mess on Wall Street came from the police horses standing guard in front of the New York Stock Exchange. Uh-huh.
That's it.
And I think that sums it up.
Uh-huh.
There we go. It's all horse manure. But the cause is, no, the cause is truly worthy, and I've had my faith in that this would turn into that kind of movement, and I'm very pleased to see that we have actually been misinformed by our beloved media.
Well, what's really interesting is some of the things that you'll see about not just on Wall Street. I mean, we had Occupy Chapel Hill,
mm-hmm.
and they met in front of the post office, which is where everything happens when,
yes.
when there's anything going on. And then there was another thing I saw where they were occupying, it was some agricultural field out in Illinois or Indiana or something mm-hmm. like that. It was like, occupy where the food is being produced.
Oh, yeah.
So this has gone, across the country.
The documentary Food Inc., yeah.
Many, many manifestations of people.
And it's getting stronger. And it's worldwide at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's going, so, it's being, yeah, I think the...
Interesting to see.
I've always said that the truest form of... Oh, what is it? The word I'm looking for, the truest form of democracy that we've ever had, we have in our computers and our accessibility to the world. So this is really
it. I can make a point, too, that make sure that they don't start wanting to charge people to get on the Internet.
Yes.
So
yeah, we're still having to fight that.
We've got to stay free.
Yeah, they're going to keep on trying to do
freedom of expression, essential to a free society. It's my password here.
That's right, and that's what happens here at the Speakeasy.
What's going on at the Carolina Theater?
They've got all kinds of shows coming up. I didn't bring the list with me. Just go to carolinatheater.org and you can catch on. But they are, they've gone from booking around 18 to 20 major events annually to 50 or more now.
And they so are the place is our hopping. Underwriters.
Indeed. They underwrite the Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theater here on WCOM 103.5 FM. Thought I'd get that in.
Okay.
And we've got a fascinating soul in the studio today. He's actually been here once before, but... didn't really get a chance to interview him along with some of the bluegrass musicians he was hanging out with. But today it's going to be Jimmy Bird. And Jimmy Bird has a background in racing, not just racing himself and having some dirt track victories, but also working for a legend in the NASCAR scene. And I think you've probably met all of the legends. What I'd like to do is give people, especially kids listening or anyone inclined to consider racing as something they want to do in life.
Kids at heart.
Kids at heart, indeed. Like me. Hey, I'm never growing up. Older, yes, but... The Jimmy Buffett tune, grow in older but not up. But I want Jimmy to give us all sides of that particular lifestyle, the pros and cons, and trust me, it's a very dangerous lifestyle. I mean, I realize fully that any sport is dangerous, but none quite so dangerous as racing. Good morning, Jimmy. This is Jimmy Bird.
Good morning, Claudio. Glad to have me back here. Appreciate you inviting me to come back and talk to you racing.
I was absolutely amazed at some of the stories you told me. I've been sort of a fan of watching racing ever since I was a kid. I even read books on it. But there is just so much that we take for granted with a rather romanticized image of the sport.
Yeah, racing is it's a dangerous sport. It's fast, it's quick. And
take us back to the days when you were actually dirt track racing.
Well, back when I first got started in the racing, I worked with J.D. McDuffie's brother, Glenn McDuffie. We run a 1965 Ford, won a lot of races.
Explain to us who they are, in case anybody doesn't recognize the names.
Well, J.D. McDuffie was a NASCAR driver. His brother's name was Glenn McDuffie, that run in the late model sportsman class back in the 60s. We run at a bunch of different dirt tracks, won about 50 races one year. It got to where people sort of hated to see us coming because we run so good. We run a race down in Leland one night. We was 14 laps ahead of the field, and the biggest bolt in the race car broke on the rear spring. Didn't Ooh. Nobody have bolts that big. And it was a challenging experience, learn a lot on the dirt track. And then one day, Glenn's brother, J.D., offered me a job to go to work in NASCAR, so I went to work with J.D. in 1970, and I worked with him to the last race of 1983.
Goodness.
When Bobby Allison won the championship out in Riverside, California.
Now, give us some of the experiences you went through. I know you worked on the mechanical end of things. I, for some reason, assumed that you even did a few races, but take that back. But, of course, you had the inside scoop on behind the scenes at NASCAR, which is some pretty valuable stuff. I'm curious as to some of the things that affected you from the mechanical end of things and also some of what you witnessed on the racetrack.
Oh, yeah. At the races, you go every week from every state in the United States, except some of your northern states. You see all kind of mishaps on the racetrack. In the garage, people is getting hurt. There's things that the average public don't see during the week. Different incidents.
I realize some of these are gory, a little gory details, but I want people to hear this.
There's been big people wrecked at the racetrack. We had a good friend that raced out of Rome, Georgia, Henley Gray. He had a pretty serious wreck up in Brooklyn, Michigan.
What happened?
The ball joint on the car broke from a previous race where the spindle was, the whole tapered part was tapered that got overlooked, and it wasn't actually the ball joint's fault. The tapered part is what actually let it break. And he come off the racetrack, hit the inside pit wall, and it tore the car up so bad it broke both his feet, and they were turned around backwards facing the opposite direction.
My goodness.
And it likely killed him. He had other injuries in the same wreck that was pretty violent. And his son crawled a fence that was probably 20 foot high, had barbed wire on top of it. He went over it just like it wasn't there, trying to get to his dad's car.
Mm.
And they've been several fire accidents up in Michigan. Bobby Warwack out of Charlotte, North Carolina, was in a wreck, got burnt. His hands was burnt so bad that he got out of the car and started running down the inside the racetrack before the rescue squad could get to him. And
he was actually trying to walk to the nearby hospital, is what you were telling me. I remember earlier.
Sir, and his hands was burnt so bad the meat was falling off of him while he was running.
Mm.
And fire is a dangerous sport in the racing.
Of course, we had that recent incident with the recent death of, I'm trying to remember the fellow's name, Dunn Weldon, but the young guy was in his 30s, I think, that just recently had a fatal accident, the English race driver.
Yeah, he was involved in a serious wreck with a whole bunch of cars.
It surprised me that a racetrack would allow the incline to become so steep. It seems to me that at the incline that he was, you know, close to the wall, the slightest thing would make you roll.
Well,
you're literally looking downhill sideways.
I saw something about that on TV, and there was somebody who had been asked to be in the race or invited to be in the race, and he said he declined because he said it wasn't safe.
Yeah.
He said it was just not angled right. Or
yeah, it looked dreadful to me. And what I also didn't realize was that they were combining amateurs with professionals in that race, and they had 15 more cars on the track than should have been allowed.
Mm-hmm.
So quite surprising to hear all that.
Well, the speed that these cars run, they got a lot wider tires on them. They're open wheels. Your tires are not covered up. No kind of sheet metal roll bars or anything.
You said the tires were 11 inches wide. Is that right?
Well, the Indy cars are a lot wider.
Hmm.
As far as their racing program.
What amazed me is that you told me that the rubber on these tires is only, in some cases, only a quarter inch thick. Which just amazes me that that can even last a race.
Yeah, most tires are, most of these speedways, the tires are about 7/32 thick.
Hmm.
And like Talladega, Daytona tires are like 3/32. And the speeds, you're running so fast that they won't dissipate the heat fast enough, and they will sling the rubber off the tire.
Oh, my goodness.
And they require in NASCAR 11 inches tread width. And the Talladega tires are actually a little bit narrow because of the speed factor.
Hmm.
3/32 is not much rubber to be running 200 mile an hour.
It just stuns me that that could survive an entire race.
And if you don't get rid of the heat in the tire will come apart even hard as the tire manufacturers try to develop a tire.
Now, what were some of your experiences as far as on the mechanical end goes? What were some of your inspirations?
Well, I think everybody that works on the car, they should make the whole crew drive the car a few laps on the racetrack to get the respect.
So that they can appreciate what the driver's going through.
What the driver's got to evaluate every day when he goes out on the line. It looks a lot different on pit road, looking at every car that goes by, even though you've worked on it for years. It's a different view when you're looking through the windshield.
No doubt.
I got to drive the car twice at Rockingham and at Charlotte, testing tires after the test was over. Actually over, we took, JD had me to take the car out and drive it at both tracks, and I'd worked on it about 10 full years before we tested the tires for Macquarie Tire Company.
Mm-hmm.
And out of Pennsylvania. And it's a different aspect of the speed that you're running when you actually get out in the car and drive it on a super speedway track. It's entirely different than looking at it on the garage aspect.
In what way? Explain.
Well, the speed is so fast, no faster than I was running. I was running about 20, 25 mile an hour less than the pole was running. I didn't run but 7-8 laps. Cause
and how fast were they going? So what was your speed?
The speed, the pole back then was 152 mile an hour, and I didn't run but about 7 laps. I run right around 134 average mile per hour.
That's a good clip.
And it turned about 7,200 RPMs. And when you get down in the turn, it feels like the seat is actually going to go through the floorboard. No faster than I was running. And the drivers that drive every day, they are up against a big challenge on the speed of the car and the handling.
They can go over 200 miles an hour, right?
At Talladega and Daytona, they can get right at 200 mile an hour. And Atlanta's getting to be a pretty swift racetrack.
Now, are there any other racetracks? Where was the track where the English fella just got killed? That wasn't Talladega, was it?
No, it wasn't Talladega.
I was just wondering if there were any other racetracks with that kind of a steep incline toward the wall.
Well, Daytona, Talladega, Nashville used to be banked real bad, the old speedway.
And you've told me in some cases some of these banks were taken down, were leveled out.
The old racetrack at Nashville, Tennessee, was higher than Daytona, Talladega, and they'd had 7 or 8 people in the sportsman class that had been killed there because of the speed factor.
It just seems to me that sooner or later you're going to be pushed in that direction by depending on who you're trying to overtake or somebody pushing you, that it's going to be inevitable that you're going to get close to that wall and close to that or on that incline. And that incline to me just seems to be begging for an accident, but that's just an onlooker's view opinion.
Yeah, you get 30 cars involved in a race and you get all huddled up, one little mishap.
What gets me is I mean, you talk about you going out and doing the 7 laps, but there weren't any other cars on the track at the time, right?
No, ma'am. You were testing. Only one out there.
And that's, you know, that's scary enough in my mind. But to do that when you've got, how many cars are there in a race?
They used to start back in the 70s. They started 40 cars and then they cut it back.
Man.
I mean, I don't even like to drive on the road with 40 cars around me. Doing 60 or 50.
But. It was in 71, I think I got the year right. We started 60 cars at Talladega, Alabama.
My God.
And the fourth lap of the race, they had a Sears pileup on the back straightaway. And it took out about 20 cars in that one wreck. And there was motors laying on the ground, rear end housing, springs, transmission parts.
One little thing, one
like
little
a salvage
slip
yet, huh?
of your attention or one little gear or cog or something that goes wrong and, you know, you're toast.
Yep. Yes. There was violent crashes. The one thing about in NASCAR and any late model sports and any sports that's people are involved in, there's danger in every sport. In NASCAR racing, the fire hazard is probably more scary than getting killed, because there's been so many people that's been in fires in the wreck.
And, even if you survive, you've got a permanent injury.
Yes. Yeah. JD, the guy I worked for 14 years, was in a violent wreck after I had quit working for him at Daytona and got his hands burnt real bad. And he had to wear gloves to the end of the year when it got to, when the season was over. He had to go have his hands operated, and his hands was cut up between his thumbs where his thumb would even work from being burnt so bad.
And he continued to race in that state?
He raced up until he got killed in 91 at Watkins Glen, New York, in a road course racetrack.
It almost sounds like an addiction.
Yeah, he always said
addicted to racing.
Yeah, he run late model sportsman before he ever got into NASCAR in 1969, and I went to work for him in 1970, and worked for him to 1983, and seen a lot of violent crashes at the racetrack. People get hurt, bones get broke.
Give us some descriptions of what actually happened to the cars before the accident, or what caused some of these accidents. I noticed you have a whole list there of some of the famous souls that you met and had association with, but you've also got a list that I would call a death list of all these famous souls that
pretty much gave
their life to the sport.
All the years that I worked in NASCAR, we had a lot of friends that I knew that had got killed in racing. Richard Petty's nephew got killed down at Talladega in the pits. Water tank blowed up.
Ooh.
And he was about four pits down from us. And Grant Adcox was in a wreck at Atlanta, got killed. Sonny Easy was in a wreck out in Riverside, California, and got killed.
Give us some of these. I'm not trying to go dark on the show, but give us a little connection to the wreck itself. What caused these wrecks?
Well, you get in a pile of cars, it's huddled up. You don't have to touch running that kind of speed. Hunters like Charlotte when Neil got killed, he was running about 170, 175 mile an hour. Mm. And you just touch a car, not by meaning to touch the car, but it just enough to get it upset, and it loses its control, and you were in the wall, and you just in for the ride then.
Oof.
You don't know what the circumstances is going to be and the outcome.
You essentially lose control of the vehicle.
Yep, in certain circumstances, and sometimes you overdrive the car and wreck your own self. You just don't know what situation is going
to
be.
I've seen a few of them roll by just the slightest nudge to the left, and next thing you know, that thing's bouncing all over the tracks.
Just like Talladega, for instance, all your restrictor plates where the cars are so bundled up, and the restrictor plates, the drivers hate them. You can get
What's a restrictor plate?
It's an aluminum plate that goes under your carburetor. That slows your car down. It kills a bunch of horsepower where it won't run way over 200 mile an hour.
So it's like a governor that's installed?
Yeah, it's a flat plate, and it's not tapered in the NASCAR series. From an inch and 11 sixteenths hole in the diameter of the throttle bores under the carburetor, it'll go down to like about the size of a quarter, a nickel, and it kills 200 horsepower right quick. It bundles up the cars, and anything can happen when they all bunched up.
Hmm.
You don't have no room for no error. And a lot of times you're in a situation you can't change it. Stuff happens, it's just out of control.
No doubt at that speed, yeah. The fastest I personally ever went was about 110 miles on a 750 custom Honda. The Honda Harley look, but I remember doing that on 64 West many moons ago.
I hit 100 once in a Mercedes.
Oh, goodness. Good one.
But I was going down, and I can't get a ticket now because it's passed, but that's as fast as I ever went, and I thought, these cars were built to go on the Autobahn.
Yes, definitely.
But then I quickly slowed down. I was like, okay. I had my little 100 mile an hour run. That was enough.
And I hitchhiked on the Autobahn in Germany, trying to get from one town to another. Uh-huh, and talk uh-huh. about some, I mean, you couldn't, in some cases, you couldn't even make out what just flew by you. I remember this Mercedes, guy in a Mercedes picked me up, and a ride that would normally have taken 45 minutes or so was knocked out in like 15, 20 minutes and dropped me off where I needed to be.
Well, you feel like you're driving in a you know, you're driving in a bank vault.
Yeah, you are.
It's so solid.
Quite literally.
You know,
and that time I was doing 110, a buddy of mine pulled up next to me on a Triumph, and I thought he wanted to race because we were always playing little motorcycle games with each other. And what a buddy was actually trying to do is tell me he just saw a cop and I needed to slow down. The cop pulled him and asked him, what the hell is your buddy doing? Is he playing chicken? And didn't even try to chase me, but I think he got out of trouble because the cop felt that he couldn't treat one person more severely than another. So he got a big warning. But he told me that later on that night.
So what do you think drives people, Jimmy, to racing? What's the pull?
Good question.
Well, a lot of you young people that is young and watch programs that's on TV, and maybe their parents is already involved in racing in different sports, motorcycles, cars, go-karts, get involved in it, and it sort of gets in your blood, and it's hard to get out of it. And
of course, you've got to be able to afford it, for one thing. That's not a cheap sport.
And every year, it gets tougher and tougher.
Now, you were telling me that, you know, we were talking on the way over here, that basically the rich have pretty much sewed up the sport because the regular Joe can't afford to be part of these races anymore, can they?
No. Back in the early years, they had a right many cars that you could have your public job during the week,
mm-hmm.
and go racing on the weekend. Well, in 1970 and 71, 72, 73 come along, you started getting sponsors involved in racing, name brand sponsors.
Yeah.
That put a lot of money in the cars. It was like six cars that was going to win every race. And the rest of the day you would run from sixth place on. They started getting high-dollar companies sponsoring different cars. And every year it got to sponsoring more and more and bigger sponsors getting in.
Right.
And the money factor on the sponsor got to getting bigger and bigger, and it got harder and harder for the independent.
So next thing you know, the sport went completely commercial, so to speak.
Yeah, it got to be where it wasn't all fun on the weekend. It was a money situation. It was strictly business.
Mm-hmm.
And it finally got to the point that where Richard Petty was having a hard time even making the race.
You're kidding.
But he had been in it a long time. And the money had got real big. And cylinder heads cost you like $1,200 a pair back in the early 70s.
Wow.
God.
And then they went up to like $25,000 for a pair of heads.
Oh, my goodness.
Because the money factor from the big companies, it was there, and they sort of knew that the money was there, so they started charging more. Well, the independent can't afford great big high-dollar cylinder heads and stuff.
Became a sport for the fat cats, basically.
Yeah, and it made it tough on them. There was a lot of independents that they just made a living. That was it.
We're lucky to get their money back, basically.
Yeah, if you ain't broke even, you'd be doing good. Time you bought everything you needed for the tires. In 83, our used tire bill was $38,000.
Yay.
And
used.
That was used tires that we had bought from other teams. And
now, were these tires even still
safe?
Qualifiable? I was wondering, would they even qualify for another race, these tires?
Yeah, a lot of your tires, the guys that won a lot might not have but a few laps on them, and they'd put another new set on. And some of your super speedways, the cars that won all the time, some of them have 20 sets, tires, maybe more. per race already mounted, plus whatever they got mounted after the race started.
Hmm. Well, you see that when they stop at the pit. I mean, a few times I've watched races on TV or something like that, and it looks like they're boom, 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 boom. They take a tire off, put another tire on, and off they go. It's just wild.
We had a good crew. I was the only one that worked full-time with JD year-round, and we had a bunch of guys at home there that come to most of the races that wasn't a long ways from home, and we had a pretty decent pit crew.
What does the pit crew do? I mean, when the car goes into the pit, why is it doing it, and what does the crew do?
Well, the crew's got, you got two guys changes the tires. Mm-hmm. You got one jack man. One man is actually putting fuel in the car, and you got another man that's handing him the second can, and you got one guy that totes tires.
And you told me some pretty horrendous things happened with the pit crews, like a tire coming off one of the race cars and killing one of the crew members or decapitating somebody.
Yeah, we had an accident that we didn't, but a car on the track at Talladega messed up on the racetrack, and it come down across the infield and hit the inside wall, and it cut a guy both his legs off. The nose of the car hit the pit wall on the inside.
So it's not even dangerous. It's dangerous enough to drive it, but it's even dangerous enough
even
to be
that
on the
part
track.
Is dangerous, yes.
Yep. It's a dangerous sport. There's plenty of room for error, but you can get hurt on pit road just as easy as you can out on the racetrack. I got my old big toe broke at Talladega.
Oh, yeah?
Air ball fell off the pit wall and hit it. I went on and worked the whole race for it, took my boot off. I knew it was broke, but I didn't.
In comparison with getting your legs chopped off, I think you got by pretty clearly.
Yeah, and the guy got run over at Atlanta, mishap on pit road. Things that just happened, that unforeseen, but it's dangerous in any sport.
I would say it's more dangerous than practically any sport I can think of.
If a young person is wanting to get involved in it, they need to really sit down and think about if they got the nerve to do it, want to do it, or can I do it. You got to have that willpower to work on it. There's a lot of nights if you ain't got enough people working for you that you have to work all night long. We've been down that road.
Your speed and your efficiency is so critical, so critical. I mean, it so much depends on the guys in the pit.
Yeah, they can make the race. They can make you win the race or lose the race. You can be the fastest car there and still not win. Mm-hmm. We would have won a race at Nashville, Tennessee one night, led a bunch of the race, and got down to about 60 laps to go. And when the tires gave up, I called him on the radio and told him, and we pitted and under the green, and you lose two laps at Nashville on a short track if you pit under the green. We were two laps down, and a rain shower would come right after we pitted. And the rest of the guys got to pit under the caution, so we were two laps behind then and was leading the race when we pitted. And
did you catch up again?
When the race was over, we was back to fifth place. And when it was over, and we'd had a couple more laps, two or three laps at the most, we'd have been back in the front again because we were the fastest car there, unless we'd have been involved in a wreck or something. Stuff, you know, unforeseen.
Mm.
But
going back to Dunn Weldon, the fellow that just died on the track, it looked to me like that entire, I mean, he was literally sitting in, the cockpit was ablaze. I'm wondering what would have caused the fire to take place in the cockpit while the vehicle outside seemed like it was still running, even though it was already in the state of an accident. But I was just wondering why the flame was confined to the cockpit.
Well, I don't know for sure where the car got turned around and where the fuel cells in those cars are located at.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have come probably from one of the cars he was involved in, too. You don't know how much fuel was spilt from the cars that was in the wreck.
Yeah, that's something you don't think
about. It could
have
been all over the car. The fuel cells is probably the best thing they ever developed in the NASCAR.
Explain that.
It's a gas tank that's got a bladder in it like foam stuff with a got a big steel marble, two big steel marbles in the top of it where the fuel goes in. If you turn the car upside down, that steel ball falls to the bottom. And it don't let the fuel run out the same hole you put the fuel in. And they're pretty safe. They're made in a can. The fuel cell's in a can, and then it's made in another compartment that looks like a can. And it's got this big foam stuff like you see come out of the ocean inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty safe.
Helps keep the fire from spreading or even the fire from happening at all.
But some wrecks, you can get in, they'll be so violent that it can rupture the fuel cell.
Hmm.
But your fuel pumps on your older models that we used to run was on the front of the engine, and it'd break it off, and that's where you'd get fire, or the oil lines get tore off in the wreck and hit the hot headers, about 1,200 degrees in temperature.
Oof.
And then you got a fire from the oil, not the gas.
And you said that it was 1,200 degrees when you're driving because the wind's actually cooling you, and what, 1,400 degrees when you're sitting there ready to start the race?
Sitting there idling, the cylinder temperature is about 1,400 degrees. Full throttle, the gas and the air that's coming down through the carburetor, it'll cool it down to about 1,200 degrees, 1,250. And that's on each individual cylinder.
It's like sitting in a bomb.
Literally, yes.
Yes.
They put out a lot of heat.
No doubt. Well, give us some of your inspirations, some of the people you met, the things you really enjoyed about being involved in the sport for so long.
Well, I enjoyed the racing part, the working part.
Of course, your racing part was pretty much with the dirt tracks, right? You didn't actually race in NASCAR.
No, I didn't race none as far as driving in a race in NASCAR. I won some street races in the
that's pretty cool.
sportsman section, 4 or 5 races. That was fun, but you can have a good time, and when it comes to paying for the parts, when you got your own car, it gets expensive.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. You can put yourself out of business right quick.
Not a hobby
dirt track
I could afford.
Or NASCAR. Or a late model sportsman in the parts department for buying if you don't have a sponsor.
Oof.
There's no way you can make it.
It's definitely become a sponsorship game. Drop some names on us. Who are some of the people you enjoyed meeting?
Well, I got to know Dale Earnhardt real good from when he first started.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby Allison, which I got to talk to last week out at the airport there in Sanford. They had the airport had their open house a day every year. And he was up there and got to talk to him about 20 minutes.
All right.
And I had a lot of good friends that I knew and raised from North Carolina, some in California. And there was just a bunch of people I got to know real good.
So you've been all over the country in doing this.
Yeah, we've been in, I think me and J.D. had been in all the states traveling except 9 in the United States, not counting Alaska or Hawaii, and met a lot of people.
Right. I guess so. That's an experience in itself.
No doubt. You could write a book about some of that stuff.
Yeah, me and my wife went in the Walmart store in East Tuboga, Alabama, and went down to see my youngest stepdaughter. And there was 4 people in that one store. Called me by my first name. It tripped her out.
Wow.
She couldn't believe it.
Uh-huh.
And it was an experience that she didn't know. I told her, I know people all over the United States.
Yeah, absolutely.
And got a lot of good friends in Riverside, California that helped us on our pit crew out there.
Mm-hmm.
That we really look forward to seeing every year we went out there. In the early 70s, we raced twice at Riverside and once in Ontario. So 47 hours driving time from Sanford to Riverside,
that's
California.
And you made that with one pill.
I took one time, and that was all I took. I said, no more then.
I don't even see how you can do that. I mean, just drive that many hours. And you said then you went back and you started working on the vehicle that you just brought back. And what, then a day later or so, you dropped and slept for 2 days straight?
Yep. I took one pill one time coming back from California, and I worked. Drove all the way from Riverside, California to Sanford, North Carolina.
My God.
And got home and still wasn't sleepy. I took the engine, transmission, rear end out of the car, changed the shocks and the A-frames for the next race. And when that old pill wore out, I slept for 2 days. Oh, I won't never take another one.
I don't even want to know what that pill was. I don't even want to know.
They called them California turnarounds back in the 70s.
Something to do with the truck driver, maybe?
Yeah,
that truck driver. Pills,
so
yeah.
You actually drove nonstop?
Nonstop.
That is insane. I just don't get it.
I'm glad you made it. All I can think of is I'm glad you made it.
He's got driving in his blood, I'm sure, but that's still...
Stop, put gas in the car or the truck, race truck, at filling stations.
And you didn't fall asleep at the pump while you're pumping it?
No. I was a lot younger back then, too.
Goodness. It's scary to know there are people like that on the road.
Yes.
Well, they get under control now a lot more. You got log books now. You have to keep a check how many hours you drove, how many times you stopped, rested, or whatever. And... it didn't concern the racing, but I went and got some furniture one time in Pennsylvania, and the policeman stopped me for the taillight that quit burning on my trailer. And he said, "Where's your log book at?" I knew what he was talking about.
Uh-oh.
I said, "I ain't never hauled no logs in my life."
Did you get out of it?
He wrote me up for the reflectors. Didn't have no reflectors. And a tail light, but I knew what he was talking about. I said, "They never hauled no logs in my life."
You had to get out of that one. My God.
Oh boy.
But NASCAR is a good sport. But if a young person wants to get into it, he really needs to think about it, because it's a dangerous sport.
No doubt. You probably need $1 million just to even consider doing it. First of all,
your tire bill alone can put you out of business.
Uh-huh. My God.
And my understanding now, they make you buy 3 new sets before they even let you on the racetrack.
Yeah, you told me that they have all kinds of regulations now that sort of take the fun out of the sport as well.
Yeah,
name some of those.
The fun part of it is actually gone now. It's really a strictly business.
That's a pity.
But what about stock car races? Now, what are they?
Well, that's basically what NASCAR started as.
Right, but they still have stock car races, don't they, or not?
No, they do in your late model sportsmen, people that run on your dirt tracks and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they're a lot different now than they used to be. They was basically stock frames and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And now they'll let you run tubing frames and handmade frames under them.
So everything's become regulated at this point?
Yeah, well, it's really a lot safer with your tubing frames, because you've got more... stability in the car as far as the safety factor.
So what are you doing now when it comes to getting on the road?
He's got a moped.
A bicycle.
Yeah, I quit all my crazy wild driving a long time ago. You got to learn to respect that.
I'm sure you're still capable, though.
Oh, yeah, you can still do it, but you know better.
Yeah, right. At least you can get yourself out of a fix if you have to.
Yeah.
I'm glad you lived long enough to learn that.
Yep. A lot of these young people, if they only knew that car don't care who it hurts,
no,
they would still be some living today.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a pair of pliers. It's about as effective as that. It's a tool you're driving.
I took one of my racing motors I had in a 65 Ford. I drove it 3 weeks. I took it out. It'd run fast as you wanted to run. It got 3 miles to the gallon. It didn't matter if you run it 40 mile an hour or 200 mile an hour.
Uh-huh.
It got 3 miles a gallon. And it would hurt you because it had so much horsepower.
Uh-huh.
And first cousin, he got upset because I took it out. I said, "That thing will kill you." Uh-huh. I said, "It don't care who you are sitting in the steering
wheel."
No,
it's got absolutely no connection except...
I still got the engine, but I ain't put it back in.
So what are you doing these days? Because you're still repairing cars, fixing cars and for friends and people that hire you for it, right?
I do a lot of mechanic work for different people, do some painting.
Mm-hmm.
And when I ain't doing that, I'm doing some woodwork. I like doing woodwork, which I've done some of that.
Jack of all trades, yeah.
Before I ever got into the racing part-time.
At some point, you're going to help me rebuild some stuff on my property. So he's practically a neighbor, so there's no reason not to.
When you say woodwork, what kind of woodwork?
Well, I used to make, me and my wife made stuff after I got out of racing. I made 55 items for Waccamaw Pottery Corporation down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Really?
And they had 29 stores. Started out with five.
Yeah, I remember that, actually.
What kind of items?
Ducks, wood chefs, Chippendale planters.
Wow.
Very talented fellow.
Old-timey churns.
Nice.
All kind of wood items.
Also Christmas items that I think you sold annually. Yeah.
Make little reindeer planters.
Yep.
I got an order one time from Waccamaw.
I got one of those, actually.
30,000 of them in 10 days, and I turned the order down. They called me back the same day, wanted 15,000. I turned it down. 3 days later, I got an order in the mail for 5,200 in 10 days. Me and my wife and stepdaughter made, and my oldest son, we made 2,000 in 10 days.
Wow.
From start to finish, boxed them up, and carried them to Myrtle Beach.
Good heaven.
I hope there was a decent paycheck in that.
Well, I don't know about the decent paycheck, but I know it was a lot of work.
Oh, my goodness.
Number one selling item in the pottery for a 10-week period.
Uh-huh.
Incredible.
And they were selling them faster than they could make them.
Hmm.
And I carried them. We carried them down to the...
You could have put somebody in business, started a small factory somewhere.
Yeah, I carried them to the distribution center and got there at 3 o'clock that day. And the next day, about 3:45, he called me and told me that all them reindeers I had brought the day before, they had unsold them.
Hmm.
They lasted one day.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd heard about these things and about you long before I met you through Ralph O'Quinn. And then, of course, met you through the Bluegrass Gang.
Yeah, we got some good bluegrass group there that plays there at Machine Shop.
Ronnie Brown and the gang at BMF Tool and Die, yeah. We had some good times there. One of these Mondays I'm going to show up again. I have not been available on Mondays.
Yeah, it was a good gang that plays there on Monday night at the Machine Shop.
Mm-hmm.
And they got some girls and boys, too. You'll have to get them up on your show one day.
I will.
They have some real good music.
Two of them I'm particularly interested in having on, sort of folk ballad singers. They are very good.
Do you do anything along the music lines?
I've been trying to learn to play the electric bass sound.
Uh-huh.
I'd love to have a doghouse bass because they're easier to play.
A doghouse bass?
That's what they call the big upright, big tall bass.
Right, right.
That's what you learn to play when you get kicked out to the doghouse too often.
Yeah, you had to go out and hide in the barn.
That's it. So, boy, you play that well. I think I know what happened here.
Yeah.
So give us one more rundown of all the NASCAR legends that you know personally, and then we'll just sort of wrap the show up with that.
Well, Dale Earnhardt, Bobby Allison, I knew Neil Bonnet, Buck Baker. I didn't know him real good, Buddy Baker, back in the day when I was there all the time. Henley Gray from Rome, Georgia, he was a good friend. There's so many of them, it's hard to remember. On Cuckoo Marlin.
And, of course, the guy you worked for, now he's record in the racing.
J.D. McDuffie, he won... He run about 600 races all together. Mm-hmm. After I quit, I'd went to, I think, 444. It's pretty accurate on how many races I had been to with him. So
wow,
I'd been all over the United States traveling with him.
And, of course, he died in one of the races.
Yes, sir. After all, in 91, he was in an accident at Watkins Glen, New York. I had quit working with him in 84.
What happened?
I don't know. I wasn't there, but looking at it on the TV, I think, being worked on the car all these years, that either the gas throttle had hung on it or the new transmission. He had one of the new transmissions that he had never run, and he either missed the gear and couldn't get it downshifted because the guy, Jimmy Means, was a good friend that he was in a wreck with out of Alabama, and I'd pulled and towed his car to California.
How'd Jimmy make out?
He didn't get hurt. He run into him as he went into the turn, and he would have never run into the guy because he was a super good friend.
Yeah.
As far as purposely running into him. And the car went off the turn and hit all those tires, and one of those steel beams hit him in the back of the head. The end of it went through the other window.
Oh, boy.
One of those freak accidents, and that's how he got killed. And
well, he certainly had a long life in the sport before all that.
Yeah, he'd always told me when I worked with him that if he ever got to where that thing scared him as far as driving it, he would park it and let somebody else drive it.
So he never did get scared of it?
No, until he never did quit. That's all he wanted to do was race.
Hmm.
And, I mean, he worked day and night on that thing. We drove a Buick for a couple of years. Buick dealership brought us two brand new Buicks down there, and we stripped them in 2 days. There wasn't nothing left of it.
My goodness.
And he drove it, and he'd run 155 mile an hour with hydraulic lifters. You couldn't buy nothing for the Buick.
My word.
You had to make it.
Well, I think at this point,
I've got a Buick sitting out in the driveway. I don't think I'm going to let you go near it.
My first car was a Buick Riviera. Many moons ago. It looks like we're coming to a wrap. John Paul's outside ready for his show. So I want to let everybody know you've been listening to Jimmy Bird, a bit of a race driver himself and also worked NASCAR for a good portion of his life. Jimmy, what do you want to say to wrap this up?
Well, appreciate Claudio having me here today.
Oh, that's
and
a pleasure.
All you race friends that like racing, hope you enjoy it and keep coming and
take to heart just how dangerous this sport is, and that's certainly you need a big pocketbook to begin with, but God, you can die awfully easy.
Yep. It's a dangerous sport, and it's something that you don't know what you're going to be dealt with from the time it starts till it ends. You'll either have a good day, a mediocre day, or it could be a bad day.
Or you won't be around the next day.
Yeah, that's true.
One way or the other. This is Claudio Speakeasy in Radio Theater with my co-host Audrey Layden. Sitting by, you've been listening to Jimmy Bird, and this is Claudio, your host, signing off. Until next time, you keep us tuned in, and we'll keep you turned on. Until next time, cheers.